Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October skies.
What's up? What's up, everybody? Welcome aboard to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horwitz, and after a little bit of absence, he's back. The Badger, he's coming back to join me for a couple of days. Badger, what's going on?
Well, you know, the markets have been pretty crazy, up, down, around. You know, just more of the same stuff they've been doing for the last 6 months.
It's really amazing how they rotate back and forth. And of course, yesterday. You know, the general indexes were lower most of the day, but the Russell was like way higher. And that was just basically the opposite of what happened last week. What are you seeing there? What is it? Does that mean anything? Is that laying out any message to you the way that it has been trading just like that?
You know, first of all, usually the Russell is, as we've talked about many times, usually the Russell is the lead. If we're rallying and the Russell starts to break, you should probably be looking for a break because we get the disconnect there. But right now, it doesn't seem that the market wants, unless you want to buy Netflix, it doesn't seem that the market wants to go anywhere. I mean, it'll go up like last week. And then, of course, Wednesday, it looked like it was the end of the earth. Thursday, we go down. We make a low that reaches the low from the previous week, and we skyrocket off of it on the jobs number. Yesterday and the rest of the markets, they were totally asleep.
Right. So, you know, it's like we're really I like to compare it to the mouse on the wheel or the gerbil on the wheel. And we're just running and running and running. And the faster we run, the less we really go. And of course, the tighter this consolidation gets or congestion, the bigger the breakout will be when it breaks out. And we don't know which way it's going to break, but it's certainly setting up to break one way or the other. And of course, the pundits will have you believe that selling may go away, so it'll break to the downside. And you and I happen to also think that the downside is likely, but you know, obviously an upside surprise would not be out of character, because again, markets do what markets do, and you know, we don't tell them what to do. We try to react to what they're doing so we can put ourselves in the best position. But in the meantime, we've seen some very interesting movement. And of course, Netflix yesterday, you know, approaching $600 a share. Just in your general theory and thesis, I mean, you've been around doing this a long time and you follow valuations, and you're not a fundamental guy, but you do understand fundamentals. What is your take of Netflix up at this lofty level?
Well, first of all, I think there's definitely a short squeeze going on. You know, we got that earnings report. I mean, it just simply gapped up. It's now rallied, what, since the first of the year? Netflix was trading at 330. It's up like 85% since the first of the year. And, you know, somebody's getting squeezed here, wouldn't you think?
I guess. I mean, you know, they keep coming out with good news. I don't, you know, it's always, in my opinion, it's always somebody's getting squeezed when you see these moves. But of course, you know, we always, one of the problems that investors have, especially investors more so than traders, is that, you know, you look at a $17 move and you go, wow. But really, if you just fraction it down to a $59 stock, it's $1.70. So right. It's not like we're going to the moon. I mean, you know, the bigger the stock, you know, it's like the indexes. You know, back in our day when we first started, the Dow was 1,000 or less. So a $6 or $7 move is a big move. Now, you know, it's no big deal, right? I mean, you know, we get a 100-point move. So what? It's no different. So I don't know if the numbers are artificially blipped up or, you know, however you want to look at it, but I don't get too concerned about it. I do think that a lot of the stocks like that are overvalued. You know, I think if their model, now they've done a lot of great things. Again, I'm not saying that they're not doing great things. You know, I mean, listen, I'm a subscriber. I love Netflix. I think it's great. You know, commercial free TV.
Oh, I do love Netflix.
Right? Yeah. I mean, commercial free TV, they got a lot of great documentaries, which I know you like. And even I watch them now. Why? Because I can watch them without commercials. So, you know, it certainly makes me a customer of theirs. But, you know, again, I think if they continue to get better, obviously, I think that competition is already in, but I think competition comes in even more as they get better. And I don't know how they can survive, you know, not survive, but I know how they can make money. Okay, but I don't know that they can make what they're valuing here up at these unbelievably lofty levels. You know, you agree, disagree?
No, I agree with you. A couple things. Netflix is up 33% in a month. All right. Now, how many times have we seen this movie? There is no top to Netflix. It's the next thing. There is no competition. They're just going to rule the world. And they may. But we know when you see these kind of unbelievable moves, and actually the stock is almost double in price since the first of the year, actually since the first of the end of January. It's up 85% in a little over 4 months. Now, to me, you know, is there any possible way that they can make these valuations work? Well, it doesn't really matter, does it? Because how much money does Amazon make according to their PE?
None.
Oh, yeah. How much money does Tesla make?
Less. less than none.
Yeah. And, you know, to say that Netflix is the Netflix bubble, I can't say that for sure. But when I look at the rally, I look at the size of the rally, I look at the angle which the stock is going up. You know, we've just seen this movie so many times that at some point people are going to finally say somebody's going to take profit. I remember, frankly, as you remember, the CME, when we had our stock in the CME, right? It came out at $40, went to Babe Ruth, 714, and then imploded. But it was just going straight up like this. And I think what will happen in Netflix is like with Tesla and with all these other stocks, eventually the short squeeze here will get over, because I do believe it's a short squeeze based on what I'm watching. And when that short squeeze ends, we're going to see that classic pattern, that V pattern. You know, if you remember, really, Bubba, back 5 years ago when Netflix had its first monstrous rally, and the stock went from $8 up to $2.50 before it went back to $50, that level held, and then it's been going up since then. But the angle which is going up, price is going up so quick now, as we know, it just can't go up like this forever. Somebody's going to step in and become a seller here. Somebody, and by that I mean big hands.
Right.
Hedge funds, the big banks. They're going to, if they've been long all this rally, they're going to be dumping it. They're not going to let it go up forever.
Right. No, I agree with that as well, that at some point, again, we don't know when the top is going to be, but I think that, you know, the action is always interesting. And it's always interesting to watch these things as they perform, because, again, we know certain things are automatic. And one of the things that's automatic is that stocks don't go straight up and they don't go straight down. And at some point, even if Netflix is going to 1,000, which it may at some day, yeah, it ain't going straight there today or tomorrow. And at some point, someone's going to say, you know what? Geez, I've made a lot of money here. And I'm not going to make that same mistake again of watching all that dwindle away, as many did over the years through different, you know, trading devices and through different problems. So we'll see how that plays out, you know, going there. And then, you know, of course, Tesla, you know, same thing. Tesla is moving up again and trying to punch out. And, you know, listen, you and I both agree. We both like the concept of Tesla. I mean, the cars are absolutely beautiful.
But, oh, yeah, absolutely. I love the cars. You know, the question is, Musk keeps putting back the day it's going to make money. You know, he's now, I think he's out to 2020. He says that'll be the break-even date. The batteries, now he's involved in the batteries too. You look at the capacity of storage, because we talked about this. You look at the storage capacity and the cost of those batteries, they're not competitive. They just simply aren't competitive right now. And he said, well, that's okay. By 2025, 10 years from now, they'll be very competitive.
Right. And of course, in we'll be able to be retired by then. But, you know, and that's always the problem when we look at any model, is they continue to push back the dates. And, you know, unfortunately, I think that investors tend to get caught up and they believe and all that. But we're going to have to step out here for a break. This is the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. I'm hanging out with the Badger, and with the Badger comes also the Bubba Report. The May issue is out, and we both highly recommend you check it out, because it is just unbelievable, filled with great information from the Badger himself, from me, Scott Shalady, Keith Bliss, Mike Brown, Bonnie Pittenger. We cover everything there for you, and it's one of the deals that the Badger and I are doing together, and we want you to share it with you. It's $99 a year. Go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for it today. This is the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. We'll be right back with more from the Badger after the break. The Bubba Show. Something to say to you. welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz hanging out with the Badger today. And so, Badger, you know, Friday, of course, every Friday, or actually not every Friday, the first Friday, or usually the first Friday of every month, they come out with the jobs report. And of course, last Friday was no different. It was actually the second Friday, but it was the first, I guess, tradable Friday. I don't know how they decide, and I'm sure you do, but they did come out with the job report. And of course, we had a precursor to that with the ADP jobs earlier in the week, which wasn't very good. And of course, the number on the surface looked like it was okay, but I think by the market actions, the way they interpreted the number sucked, which of course continue to say, oh, well, there's going to be more cash available for us, the wealthy. So it's a great buying opportunity to step back in the markets, and we're going to explode the markets, which they did. And they broke them out to, you know, again, trying to get back to those all time highs. But what did you think of the overall number? Give us your breakdown of just how you looked at them.
Well, I saw some things that actually this time I thought were a little more encouraging. And we'll talk about what those were. First of all, you know, when the ADP numbers came out, they were really bad, right? They were horrid. And I think what happened is anything that was going to be better than the ADP numbers were going to be good. So in April, after revising the March figures down to 85,000, they knocked those down how much? 60, 70,000?
Yeah, they did. They knocked them down even worse into oblivion, yes.
Yeah. Okay, but they did add 223,000 jobs in April. And the unemployment rate, which we really don't care about, fell to its lowest level since 2008 when we hit the financial crisis that blew out the housing market. So some of the things were interesting, but I did like a couple things that came out. The negative number we've talked about for years, right? The negative number of people looking for jobs.
Right.
So what percentage of the workforce isn't even bothering to look? That number fell to a 7-year low, which I thought was encouraging. The biggest thing I thought about the number is that the trades, the building trades, had added 45,000 workers last month. Now that was much bigger than the actual projection. And so from that point of view, I think the number was very good. Energy, which was to be expected, again, energy and energy service jobs, because you have to realize that these things are all tied in together. If you don't follow the energy market, you don't realize that. But when the energy itself isn't being taken out from the soil, service jobs that are associated with that also fall. As the rig count continues to go down, and I think the rig count is now down, what we mean by that is the number of rigs in service, because they pull the rigs off service, and I do follow the rig count, it's down to, I think, 6-year lows again. And, of course, they lost jobs. So the question will be now, is this going to be something that is going to have the Fed raise interest rates? Again, I'm not so sure why you would raise interest rates at this point. There is no inflation, and they keep talking about that. So their goal originally was, full employment was going to be 5.6%, and now they've rotated that down to 5.4%. There was a little bit of increase in the average weekly wage last month, and that increase was primarily because they started to hire back skilled workers, construction. Healthcare workers were added, and they will be continuing to be added, but most of those are not high-end service jobs. And when you think healthcare, a lot of people think it's doctors, but it's not. It's actually the lower-end service people that are working, with the sick and the elderly. All in all, I don't know how to interpret it. If it's a data-driven number, maybe the Fed will decide then in their June, I think it's 16-17 meeting, that it's time to roll things around a little bit and start to raise rates. On the other hand, bad news is good news. That means that's why we get the big rally. Yesterday, as you said, the Russell liked to go up, and everything else just sat there doing nothing for the whole day.
So, as we look, and now I think my opinion is that the economic data in general stinks. My opinion is that the economy is still in trouble. Of course, again, I think we've said this many times before, that the stock market and the economy have really nothing to do with each other at the end of the day, because they don't, because, I give you a million reasons why we shouldn't be where we are, but we are. But just from an economist point of view, and you are a, not a licensed, but a educated as an economist,
Yeah, what's degree your, in economics.
Degree,
yeah.
Right. Better to put it that way instead of me trying to fumble around here. What is your take? You look at all these things. I mean, you're very well read on the market. You're a professional. You're in the business. What do you think?
I think that the market's very unsure. I don't think the Fed has much of a plan. I really don't know what to think of it. The equity markets continue to churn. Interesting statistics. You know, I live in Las Vegas. So last month, Las Vegas gave away their data. Frankly, the business is back. Las Vegas is now over the top that they ever had back in 2007. They have more revenue coming into the strip now than ever came in. The difference is it's a different type of revenue now. Las Vegas has gone from the gambling capital. Now we can direct that later, what's happened over in Macau. It's gone from the gambling capital. Now it's always been the entertainment and food capital, right, of the world. And they've switched it around. Gambling now only accounts for 40% of the revenue coming into the strip, where in 2007 it was 53%. I don't think that gaming will ever come back to the extent that it did. Las Vegas created a lot of competition among different states to get that gaming business. We've seen what's happened, and we've discussed the implosion of the casino cycle in the Northeast, with New Jersey just getting pummeled, and now casinos in other states are starting to run into trouble. They you know, it's like everything else. It was the casino bubble, and we saw what happened when the casino bubble popped in New Jersey, when they started to get gaming in New York, gaming in Philadelphia. If you're not familiar with that area of the country, you can be in downtown Philly at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. At 5:35, you can be sitting at your favorite gaming table in Atlantic City. It's just they built their own expressway from Philadelphia to Atlantic City when gaming hit there 35 years ago. And then we saw what happened when they cannibalized it with gaming everywhere else. And I think what Las Vegas has done, and what they've changed things around, talking about how we rebuild, is they just simply changed their target market. Their target market now is retirees. Their target market is people that want to come to Las Vegas to enjoy the shows, enjoy the clubs, and of course they'll be gambling, but it's not their main source anymore. So it does reinvent itself. And the point I'm trying to bring out here is the economy can reinvent itself too. You know, as jobs have moved over to primarily entry level service jobs, which we've talked about for years, this last report actually showed some construction seems to be coming back again.
Okay, because I did say that I was in Vegas. Obviously, you know, we spent some time together last week, and I was talking to my buddies. I said, you know, this town is no longer, because my buddies are gamblers, and they're used to the gambling environment and the way that they're treated. I said, this is no longer run by the gamblers. This is now run by algorithms that say, okay, if you play this way, yep, you are going to get X amount of dollars, and that's it. There is no more, you know, going into whining with a host and, you know, having a bad trip so the host will give you a little bit of extra dough or whatever as a comp. There is no more real special treatment. I mean, I'm sure obviously there's always a few guys that have that part going for them.
But there'd be a few guys, but not like it was in the old days when we used to come out here 30 years ago when it was different ownership. Let's put it that way. And they actually did know how to treat you.
No, right. I mean, now it's every department in Las Vegas has become a profit center. There is no longer, you know, the original Las Vegas that you and I remember, and obviously the Bugsy Siegel Las Vegas was built on having the gamblers come out, play huge, huge money. And then, of course, at the end, they would lose a little bit of money and they'd give them food. They'd give them everything from hookers to food. You got anything you wanted in Las Vegas. And then, of course, now, wherever you go, they want profit. And it was, you know, back when they were skimming, and I don't accuse anybody of anything, but I'm going to just assume that it might be correct, that when they were skimming, that they were happy to take losses in all these other departments because they were making so much on the actual gambling. So it didn't matter to them. And they were happy to give you food. They were happy to give you liquor. They were happy to give you dinner shows. Why? Because they were making so much in the casino that they could use the actual write-off part of losing money everywhere else. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think that's 100% correct. It was a different philosophy, different environment, certainly different ownership group, as you've said. But when we used to come out here, you know, when I used to come out here 35 years ago, actually before I even went to Chicago, when I lived in Atlanta, we'd hop on a charter at 7 o'clock.
Hold that charter thought, because I want to talk more about this, because this is interesting, and this will tie into, you know, what's going on with this whole industry as it looks, because it is a ever-changing industry, and there are experienced some other issues going on. This is the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. I am with the Badger today. Make sure you check out thebubbashow.org. Great stuff up there. We've got the new Bubba Report ready to go. It's all yours for $99 a year. You get a minimum of 12 issues a year. Go check it out, thebubbashow.org, and we'll be right back after the break. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz.
You're so delicious. You're so soft. Sweet on the tip of my tongue. You taste like sunlight. And strawberry bubble gum.
What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here. The long-awaited Bubba Report. Bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Cialady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got the Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We've got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report.
Trust. For nearly four decades, that is the reputation Roberts & Roberts Brokerage has forged with their customers. Now, with their full e-commerce website, rrbi.co, it's easier than ever to buy or sell precious metals via Bitcoin or major credit card. Visit them online at rrbi.co or call 800-874-9760 to speak with an experienced professional today. Roberts & Roberts, when you're serious about precious metals.
Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz hanging out with the Badger, and of course a couple of also the gamblers. We do like to play, but so Badger, you were telling us about when they used to bring out the charters. So take us through the story, because I think it's a great story.
Well, in those days it was different. We had a host that actually lived in the city of Atlanta, and we would have a charter jet. I mean, we would come out in a 727 we'd come out in. And we'd get to the airport, Hartsfield International, at 7 o'clock in the morning. We'd give them our bags. The party started as soon as we took off, came out here. We'd get out of the plane, the chartered plane of McCarran. And in those days, if you remember, Bubba, McCarran was like a tiny little airport.
Oh, yeah. It only had the A and B gates. Now you need a cab to get around that airport.
No. Yeah. Now you need a cab. Yeah. And now you got the international terminal, which is one of the biggest airports in the world by itself. And it was very small. You know, you come right out to the front. You get out of the plane. They would have buses for us right there on the tarmac. We'd hop into the bus. We, in those days, we went to the Sahara, which was really a top-notch joint at that time. It was one of the best. That or the Desert Inn. We'd go to either one. And the bus would get there. You'd go in. All your paperwork was done. If you were, you know, if you were a gambler and you liked to gamble, your credit lines were all set up. You didn't have to talk to 300 people. You didn't have to give them. You just sat down, showed them your driver's license. They asked you how much you want. Your bags, you never saw them. They'd show up in your room right there for you. And we had our own dining room. Literally, our group from Atlanta had our own dining room. So we didn't have to worry about it. If we wanted restaurants, that was fine. But they had an unbelievable buffet for us each night. So there was no reason to go to another restaurant. And like you said, you got comped for all the shows, all your cocktails. And, you know, if you had a bad trip, you might be able to negotiate a settlement with them.
Right.
It's just completely the opposite today, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's nothing like that. Everything is just different. In those days, the pit bosses controlled everything.
Right.
You made fun with the pit bosses and he liked you. You know, you're getting whacked a little bit. They'd say, okay, you know, Here, we want you to come back again. You want to have a good time. We took care of everything. And then, you know, maybe we'll negotiate down if you've had a bad trip. We want you to come back. That doesn't exist anymore. Like you said today, it's a completely total corporate business from A to Z. Everybody in your trip out here, I mean, the people were nice where we were, but, you know, it was all corporate from A to Z, right? And it never left that corporate.
Absolutely. No, you can, then, like I said, I walked in one time to the dunes and I happened to know the new casino manager there who actually came from Reno, which is another one of my hangouts. And he says, how much you need? And I said, 25. He goes, give him 25, you know, like of nothing. I mean, you know, now you need an act of Congress to get any money out of them, you know, and you got, it's like any other banking facility now.
Right.
A whole different thing. And they, you know, even when you go into cashing your chips now, if you bring too many chips to cash in, if you happen to get lucky and catch a run, they question you and they need your driver's license. I mean, they, you know, again, it's a whole mess, in my opinion, is the way that has changed.
Well, corporations run everything now. You know, if you've ever seen the movie Casino, at the end of the movie, they talk about it. That's when they blow up the dunes. But it's just a different business. And, you know, it's like what happened in Macau. Macau was really, they were doing a lot of money laundering. And the government came in and said, you know what, we're gonna close down the money laundering. I guess a guy, because they use it different over there. It's a big different deal. Here you got your lines of credit from the casino, right?
Right.
In Macau, you'd get it through junket brokers. And then the casino would reimburse them. So it appears that what changed it around, I guess they're still looking for this guy. Some guy had about $1.5 billion of the casino's money and he disappeared. Now, he may be disappeared forever, frankly. And if it was in this country, you know he was disappeared forever.
Is he in the desert? Do they have a desert in Macau?
Oh, they have an ocean, though.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you can joke about it, but you know what would happen here.
Yeah.
But anyway, their business just got crushed. Their revenues are down 27% in this quarter. Their gaming revenues. They've lost a lot of people. And plus, they've been building. I think they were due to open like $8 billion worth of new properties over there. And those have ground to a halt. They were saying in Vegas now, Vegas is back blowing it up again. You know, at the MGM, and you'll know this, you know, just if you're going north on Las Vegas Boulevard, where all the travel in is right beside them, where all that stuff is jammed together.
Yep.
Okay, right beside the MGM. That just sold on Thursday. I forget what that property sold for.
Wow.
But it was, of course, a lot of money. It was in the billions. Also, a group from Indonesia, I believe, is starting a gigantic $8 billion complex that's going to be slightly north and west of Sahara. So you know all that property there, the right at the corner, that place has been empty for, what, 40 years?
Yep. Right by the whatchamacallit, the
right tower. Sahara, the old Sahara.
What's the guy's name? What was the goofy guy's name that ran all the goofy gimmicks way back in the day at the needle? What the hell's name of the hotel? You know what I'm talking about, the roller coaster on the top right now, the Stratosphere. It used to be the Stratosphere.
Bob Stupak.
Bob Stupak, who had all the crazy gimmicks. Remember?
Yeah, I remember him.
Okay.
So anyway, this is going to be to the northwest of the Sahara, and this is going to be a huge project. Then that old corner that has been, how many times have they started projects on that?
All I know is they tore down my Wet n Wild, which was one of my favorite attractions outside the hotel.
Okay, well, that was actually a little bit south of the Sahara.
But it was right in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, right across the street, though. That piece that's been empty forever. Somebody finally bought it.
Okay, that was right by the gold shops that were in that little mall over. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Okay. So they're finally putting a piece up there. Here's the thing. What are they going to do with the Fontainebleau? They still haven't finished it. I mean, that's a $3 billion white elephant that's been sitting right there on Las Vegas Boulevard now for 7 years. And it's empty. They've never done any of the build out on the inside. I think your buddy Carl Icahn owns that, doesn't he?
That I don't really know. But, you know, I do know that. Obviously, I was there, and of course, there's never any recession. I mean, there is, but there, as far as the players are, there's never a recession, and people want to go there. But so when you look at the business, how's the real estate market in Las Vegas right now?
Well, the real estate market has rebounded tremendously. They still have a lot of stuff down in the Strip. It hasn't rebounded, but those houses and those condos in 2007, you know, they were trading for like $400 a square foot. It was ridiculous. I think some of them were $600, with the HOAs. However, the housing market here is actually pretty tight. They're starting to finally put in some new units. When BlackRock came in, I guess right at the bottom in 2009-10, and they bought $9 billion worth of rental property. They just came in and bought everything in sight. Some of those weren't too good of buys, but they made a fortune on it. That property is up, as you well know. I'm connected a little bit with the real estate business out here. And the property values of some of the places I know that traded just from real estate brokers I'm familiar with, some of those property values have doubled since 2009. Most of them are up 50, 60%. So the Las Vegas real estate market's good. So that probably means we're due for another crash.
And probably, and truthfully, that's probably a true story, of course, because we are seeing values again. And look, we're not predicting a crash now. We're not telling you that things are going to change, but certainly would not be a surprise to see something change here. And of course, we're going to talk about this on the other side of the break, but we still have a little time here. But Janet Yellen and some of her comments, because I think that also ties into a lot of what we're talking about here. But so when you look at the casino stocks, and they seem to have found, the Las Vegas Sands and Wynn, Wynn got down to like 100 or 110, and that seems to have found maybe a temporary bottom down there. And Las Vegas Sands got down to, 50. Of course, it was $3 5 years ago. But, Sheldon Adelson, one of the richest guys in the world, along with Wynn, another one of the richest guys in the world. And, I think that they're pretty comfortable with what's going on here. And I think that those stocks should probably reach fairly reasonable levels, even if the markets are going to soften a little bit here as well. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. They're expecting a big summer season out here. Obviously, the Pacquiao fight, it was interesting. They usually get, for Super Bowl, they usually get about 250 to 300 jets for Super Bowl weekend out here. For the Pacquiao fight, they could not land the jets. They couldn't land them. They had to divert them to North Las Vegas. They said they estimated they had 500 was the most they could possibly get in McCarran, and then they had to take it. After they used up all the private stuff, then they started to rent stuff from the airport where they could put the jets, but they got so full they had to take them over to North Las Vegas, which is a private airport not too far away. I mean, it's 10 minutes, 15 minutes from the Strip. One of the beautiful things about living in Las Vegas, you don't have to worry about traffic. It's just like Chicago, where you never have to worry about traffic.
Yeah, no, I never worry about it except the 2 hours I spent yesterday trying to get back from my Bloomberg hit. But, yeah, no, I never worry about traffic. So,
anyway,
peachy keen.
Yeah, well, it was, you never know. It's always overdone in Vegas, and probably it's overdone again.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, again, it's Vegas is always, even through the depths, I mean, the casinos were still getting business. I mean, people still managed to get to Las Vegas. Somehow, the city of sin always manages to somehow survive, even when there are troubles. Even when they're in trouble, they manage to still be in business. And of course, they have had a tremendous amount of competition. Things are not great overall in that end. But as you said earlier, and as I agree, they have turned it into an entire profit-making business, not just the gambling. And it is such an easy place to get into now, especially with the international terminal. So right. We won't have any tag days for Las Vegas right now. This is the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. I'm with the Badger. And again, we urge you to check out the Bubba Report. It's really awesome. May's issue is out, and for $99 a year, you can't beat it. You get at least a minimum of 12 issues a year. Has writings of the Badger, Bonnie Pittenger, Keith Bliss, Scotch Lady, myself, and plus the Bubba proprietary indexes. Check it out at thebubbashow.org. We'll be right back after the break. The Bubba Show. After 10,000 beers and 28 years. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz hanging out with the Badger. And so, Badger, last week, our good friend Janet Yellen was up on talking. So who knows where she was talking, but she was talking somewhere. I think maybe she had some beans for lunch or something, but she was talking about something. And of course, not the irrational exuberance of Alan Greenspan, but I think something fairly similar. What did you hear from her?
Yeah, well, she was actually at an IMM. Conference or IMF, excuse me. And she was talking with, Janet Lagarde. Is that right?
Yeah. Lagarde, whatever her name is, but another goof. Yes. Lagarde. Yeah, agreed. Yes.
And they were just having a talk. I mean, I remember clearly, I don't know if you remember, the Alan Greenspan comments were, the only reason I remember this is, I don't know why, December 5th, 1996. And I was trading. I was not in the pit. I was actually trading off the floor. And I remember when he made that comment. I can still see him talking about it. You know, he was talking about the prices. He was talking about, you know, there's risk premiums, higher prices, stocks, et cetera, et cetera. And he kept saying there's an inverse relationship between ratios and inflation. And then finally he uttered the famous words, irrational exuberance. Man, did that market tank. I mean, that thing, it was like everybody in the world was selling it, all right? Then he started to talk about what had happened in Japan. And people forget, a lot of people don't remember the real estate bubble in Japan. Well, that real estate bubble, and I can still see the headlines. I think it may have been the Chicago Trib, but it could have been the Wall Street Journal. Japan lost the war, but they won the land. And if you remember, that's when Japan started to buy up all the land in the U.S., the Japanese real estate moguls. They even bought Pebble Beach. And when they bought Pebble Beach, I remember people going, well, that's it. You know, this is it. These guys are coming over and they're going to buy Pebble Beach, probably the premier golf course in the U.S., one of the premier golf courses in the world for sure. And the Japanese, of course, paid a little bit too much for it. That was the absolute top of the bubble. And then Japan had tried to go to a form of QE, but the banks never took the write-offs in the real estate. And then I'm sure they've taken them now because it's been 20 years. But that caused Japan a whole lost economic generation. Now, Greenspan was correct with his statement, but unfortunately his timing was off. The bubble did finally pop, but it was another 4 years when the dot-com bubble popped in 2000. And of course, you remember that. When Yellen gave her version of the speech, she changed it around a little bit. And what she said is, and I'll quote her, I would highlight that the equity market valuations at this point are quite high. Not so high when you compare returns of equity to returns on safe assets like bonds, which are also very low, but there's dangers out there. She concluded that the yield differential between high-grade corporate bonds and treasuries could be a concern as the yield curve steepens. Now, you asked, tell me, what did she actually say there? You know, you talk about Fed speak. What did that actually say?
I don't know. I have to read one of her books to find out what she's actually saying. I mean, she's saying that, you know what? This goes back to the whole, my whole thesis. If I were to write a thesis on the Fed, is that they have no idea what the hell's going on. That's my real opinion. And again, you can disagree with me. I mean, I say they're smart people, but they're ignorant when it comes to actually common sense of what has to happen in this world. And I will stand by that. I don't care what anybody says. To me, they are obviously extremely bright and intelligent, have very high IQs, I'm sure much higher than mine. But when it comes to running an actual business, and I think they have no idea where they are, and they keep trying to double speak around everything. I mean, you know, you realize Lockhart from Atlanta said the other day that everything is great and we're moving along at the way we should be moving now. And if anybody really believes that, you better duck because you might get struck by a bolt of lightning because I don't see it. But and again, I could be wrong. You're more the economist than I am. You are educated as an economist. You have a degree in economics. But I mean, I don't see it and I don't know what the hell she's saying, but I know whatever she's saying is some way to defend the stock market again. And I don't understand it. Do you?
No, I don't. Certainly, as long as there's no chance to get yield on assets, fixed income assets, where they are right now, the market's going to continue to get cash. I mean, there's no question about it. They will continue to get cash and how that affects long term, because she talks about now, and this is interesting, she talked about the dangers existing between spreads and high yield bonds and treasuries. I didn't understand what risks there are in there. I mean, she's saying that the corporate bond market is paying too much or borrowing. Now, clearly, you know, the corporate bonds, companies are borrowing. Why wouldn't they borrow here?
They should, right?
Huh?
They should.
They can't lose money. It's a great deal for them. I would love to be able to borrow as much money as possible. You know, you look at what we talk about as, you know, your return on equity, return on risk. they're borrowing at 3.25%. Well, they've got such a gigantic edge in that yield that there's no way they can lose money. So I wasn't sure what she was talking about when she was concerned about the difference between treasuries and corporate bonds. Corporations, you know, the guys with the dough, as we've talked about before, have never been fatter. They've got more money sitting in their pockets now than they ever have. They're not spending that money. That money is staying inside their pocket, and they're waiting, I think, to see if the house of cards is going to fall in again. But this time, they're going to have plenty of money. And what they're going to be able to do is, last time where they were actually puking out, now they're going to be able to come back in, and they're going to be able to spend some of that money and buy up assets, troubled assets of people who are having problems.
Well, I mean, the rich have never had more money than they've had today, have they?
I don't believe so.
I mean, the uber rich, and I'm not talking about the big speculators. You know, we've talked about them in the past, but the real money, and let's use a couple of names, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates. Okay.
Yeah.
They've never had more money than they have today because they're very calculating, good investors. I'm not criticizing what they do, but they've never been able to accumulate and accomplish more because their costs are effectively zero to grab more money and take advantage of the overall system, which is, God bless them. I wish it was me. It ain't, but I wish it was. But so those guys like that, real wealth, you know, let's say the Kennedy family, all those guys that now have real built-in wealth that aren't speculating, that aren't, the big oil players or the big guys that are continuing to leverage up. These guys have real hard dollars that they have in their pocket, and they're not going to let them slide away again. And they're continuing to accumulate because of the system that is allowing them to do that. Is that correct?
Yes, I agree with you 100% the way the system is. I'm sure that some of those guys, and they're very, very smart guys, have got to have an exit strategy. They got to figure out a way that when this market, the bull finally comes to an end, these guys want to keep their money in their pockets. So they've got to have some sort of exit strategy in place. I would think maybe with the new weekly options, the probabilities of being able to learn how to hedge using the weekly options gives them a good shot that when we finally do have the collapse, no matter what happens, they're not going to lose any of their money, if anything. And then they're just really what happens is that their basis where they own everything will just be a lot lower.
And they'll be able to accumulate that more. But if you really want to know those secrets, you got to contact me at bubba@thebubbershot.org, because we are getting ready to introduce something new that will help everybody. And obviously there will be a cost to it, but we can show you those strategies, because very few understand it. But fortunately for you, we do, and we want to be there to help you, the investor. But it's something we're going to be looking at. So make sure, I've sent out that video we did that one time before on how to use them. But we are going to actually bring this into really fruition to help everybody, because what it really will allow you to do is to accumulate more down at the bottom and have cash to accumulate versus sweating it out and dumping at the bottom. But that also ties into the Bubba Report. And of course, the Badger is a big contributor to the Bubba Report. We've got my proprietary indexes. We've got Bonnie Pittenger on real estate. We've got Keith Bliss's View from the Floor. Scott Chalady from the floor of the CME. We've got Mike Brown, who is a financial analyst and also an advisor. So we've got a whole team of talented over probably close to 200 years of real experience in markets that are there giving you information that will help you make better decisions on your overall portfolio for the investors. Anyways, we appreciate you being here today. This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. Make sure you go check out thebubbashow.org, and we will see you back here tomorrow. Same time, same station. We're bringing the Badger back because we got a lot more topics to cover. The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz. See you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Have a great day, everybody. Thank you so much.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.